Due to the nature of the cases discussed in this episode, there will be some direct descriptions of violence. While we will do our best to avoid being graphic, the details may disturb some listeners, and discretion is advised. The Westin Peachtree Plaza Hotel declined to comment, and emails to the parent companies and to their PR firm were not returned. We tried for several weeks to speak personally with Unite Here's Atlanta chapter, but we were unable to reach them via phone, email, social media, or their parent organization. This is The Fall Line.
At the time, I don't think I was really quite aware of. I mean, I knew it made me uncomfortable, but I don't think I was aware of how wrong it was. You know, in my mind, it was just a thing that happened, and it, you know, we laughed about it later. Or I would, you know, ask one of the other girls at work, hey, did you have that person in that room yesterday when you did your turndown service? Were they a creep? And she'd say yes or no, and we would laugh, and that would be it. And oftentimes the management was involved in these conversations. They were there listening to us in our, like, break or whatever. And nobody really ever said anything or did anything, and we weren't really ever given any instruction on as to how to handle that or what to do or what to say or who to talk to. So, I mean, it was, people were definitely aware of it, but nobody ever said anything as to what we should do about it.
Atlanta, March 2016, around 8 p.m., Carolyn Robinson Mangum entered the walk-in freezer of the Westin Peachtree Plaza. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Carolyn had worked in the hotel's culinary department for about 35 years. At 61 years old, she may have been thinking ahead to retirement, or maybe she was simply focused on the tasks of the day, keeping a staff kitchen running smoothly in a hotel with over 1,000 rooms on 73 floors. The AJC also reports that Carolyn was well-liked by her coworkers, and those coworkers said that on that day, everything seemed perfectly normal. There were no issues and no problems. So it was odd when Carolyn, still on the clock, disappeared. And yet, the family's lawyer later reported that 13 hours passed before anyone looked for her. The search only began when her husband, concerned that she hadn't come home, called management to ask if she was still at work. And Carolyn was still at work, but she'd become locked in the walk-in freezer. It was equipped with an emergency exit button that should have allowed her to free herself. In a March 28, 2016 article, Westin representatives said that the button had been regularly tested. In fact, in the days after Carolyn was trapped, the Westin reps told the AJC that, quote, the Atlanta Medical Examiner, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and an independent manufacturer representative conducted more than 30 functional tests over five separate testing occasions on the exit device on the inside of the freezer door in question. In March of 2016, the hotel was unable to comment on how precisely Carolyn had become trapped. But she was missing for 13 hours. And according to the Chicago Tribune, when she was found early the next morning, the temperature inside of the unit was approximately negative 13 degrees. By the time she was found, her body was frozen, and there were signs that she had tried to escape. 11 Alive in Atlanta reported, quote, the medical examiner's officer also found a red and tan substance on the freezer door, resembling what may have been blood or tissue. Carolyn also showed signs of injury. She tried, and for a long time, to attract the attention of someone who might free her. But no one heard. And until her husband called, no one looked. Despite initial reports that the freezer's exit systems were functional, stories began to surface. The Associated Press reports mention of employees coming forward to say they'd also gotten stuck in the freezer in the 6 months preceding Carolyn's death. One woman had managed to attract attention by banging her fist on a wall. Another report describes an actual safety inspector becoming stuck in the freezer with another employee. In April of 2016, the coroner updated Carolyn's autopsy to include OSHA reports of prior freezer incidents at the Westin. Eventually, it was decided that the Westin should pay a $12,500 fine. OSHA also proposed a series of safety measures, including safety communication checks for employees entering freezers and even panic buttons that each employee might carry. Westin's parent company was acquired by Marriott International, who, as part of an AHLA initiative in 2018, issued the following statement, quote, Marriott is currently testing and deploying our first phase of associate alert devices in our managed hotels in the U.S. and Canada to enable hotel associates to press a button that will summon help if they feel their safety is threatened while at work. The technology, already in use in several markets, will take until 2020 to fully install, fine-tune, and integrate, and could be used to alert hotel management to other issues an associate may encounter, such as a guest in distress or a threatening situation that might endanger anyone in the hotel. However, as of January 2019, the Westin Peachtree Plaza has declined to comment on this story and whether they have panic buttons in place now, or to answer questions about staff security protocols and procedures following Carolyn's death. In October 2016, the Mangum family sued for damages. By 2017, their case was dismissed because they specifically filed a wrongful death suit, and the death would fall under the umbrella of workers' compensation. Based on the Georgia Workers' Compensation Act, the family would only be owed death benefits mandated by the GWCA itself, a percentage of Carolyn's weekly earnings, up to a maximum of $575 a week, and burial benefits of up to $7,500. It almost goes without saying, but that's not a lot. We know that people employed in service and manual labor industries like restaurants, bars, contracting, painting, tend to earn less, but housekeepers and hotel staff are working for low wages in what can be very dangerous environments. The very same hotels designed to preserve each guest's sense of a personal, luxurious oasis can create environments both hard on a staff's physical health and even threatening to their personal safety. And accidents are not the only danger. Carolyn Mangum is not the first hotel employee to die due to malfunctioning equipment or who could have benefited from a communication-based safety system. She's not even the first to die at the Westin Peachtree Plaza. In December of 1995, a member of the housekeeping staff, Elia Banderas, was murdered while on the job in the middle of the day at a high-end hotel. Elia's family didn't call the hotel to look for her. They had no reason to. When Elia was discovered by guests who'd rented the room, she was only a few hours into her shift. And, a warning, the following description may be upsetting for some listeners. Elia had been severely beaten, probably with a landline telephone receiver. It was bloody. She had also been strangled, likely with a phone's cord. Her body lay between the room's two beds. And she had only just been attacked. She was maybe still breathing when the attacker, a jacket pulled up over his head, shoved past two female guests and ran out into the hotel. He was a white male, and the jacket was maybe denim, maybe leather. And he was never caught. To understand the vulnerability of hospitality staff, you have to pull back that invisible curtain that culture has constructed between us, the served, and them, those who provide the service. And many of us shift back and forth between those roles, ordering a drink from a bartender, then serving someone else as a cashier. But few of us have been asked to be as invisible as hotel staff are. In many instances, we consider the perfect hospitality service to be the kind that you can't even see. And that's not an accident. A 2017 Atlantic article points out that since the 19th century, hotels have been designed to make staff unobtrusive and their labor concealed. That same article uses turndown service as a prime example. Author David Brodé quotes Rachel Sherman, author of the book Class Acts, Service and Inequality in Luxury Hotels. Quote, turndown service is an especially striking display of labor. Literally folding the corner of the bedding down, of course, serves no useful purpose. The gesture indicates, rather, that an invisible hand has been at work. And so, housekeepers move silently, alone, with towels and cleaning supplies and stashes of individual toiletries, avoiding rooms with a do not disturb sign, knocking softly on those that don't have them up. For housekeepers, uniforms vary widely. One housekeeper we interviewed was required to wear a dress with bare legs and no layers year-round, and others reported wearing scrubs or variations thereof. The point is to blend into the background of the hotel, especially in luxury hotels, where the often-discussed wow experience is so paramount. Because it's the hotel staff that create return guests, there's no argument there. But that experience mandates the same staff, mostly female, be unseen and unheard. The Chicago Tribune reports that 30% of that force are immigrants to the United States, and a significant percentage are women of color. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that, as a whole, housekeepers earn an average of $21,800 a year. The Economic Policy Institute points out that, as of 2014, that breaks down per day to $56, which wouldn't pay for a night in an average hotel. And those hotels where doors are closed and sounds are muted can be a perfect hunting ground. Hotel work is intensive, heavy equipment, repetitive movements, long walks with carts that can weigh over 100 pounds. The mattresses, which must be flipped, are often heavier. Unite Here, the U.S. national labor organization that represents hotel workers, reports that housekeepers have an injury rate 50% higher than other American employees. Unite Here explains that the average housekeeper cleans 15 or more rooms a day and often skips breaks or even works when shifts are over off the clock if they haven't met that quota. We didn't know these facts until we learned about Elia's case last year when the Atlanta Journal-Constitution printed a list of unsolved murders in Fulton County. That started a six-month dig into the story, and that we're telling it now has been made possible by the Atlanta Police Department, who were once again willing to serve as a resource. They remain enthusiastic about coverage for their cold cases, and they have been incredibly helpful to this work. And that's lucky, because media coverage has been spare, even though a second woman, this time a guest, was assaulted just weeks later. In February of 1996, Pauline Sarasoli of Colorado was in town for a physical therapy conference. According to the Associated Press, quote, she suffered traumatic brain injuries and remained in permanent care, passing away at a New Hampshire facility in September of 2010. And her attack was strikingly similar to Elia's, beating and likely strangulation. Pauline, or Polly, as she preferred to be known, deserves more than a brief mention in this story. And she'll get it. But to explain everything, we need to begin in 1995. When it comes to Elia, a sketch of her life is all that's available. In December of 1995, Elia was 31 years old. She was born in Mexico, probably Mexico City. At what point she began to live and work in the United States is unclear. We know she had previously resided in California, and she'd moved to Atlanta just a few months before her death, leaving her partner, Cesar Molina, back on the West Coast. At the time of her death, she and her three young children were living with relatives in a metro Atlanta suburb. Elia had quickly fallen into the rhythm of work at the Westin, where she made friends and focused on her work. All of her socializing seemed to happen during shift breaks. She'd meet friends for lunch in the employee cafeteria, the same place Carolyn Mangum would work years later. But she told the other housekeepers that she didn't go out. Her relationship status with Cesar is not definitively known, but one of her coworkers noted in an interview that Elia had not been dating. Cesar was in California at the time of her death and was never a suspect. When he came to Atlanta after the murder, he was interviewed by local media. Speaking through a translator, he told Atlanta reporters, quote, "Whoever did this should think about what they've done. He killed a mother and left three children alone." Cesar cried as he delivered the statement. After their mother's death, most of her children remained in Atlanta, living and working near the extended family. Scant records, Ancestry and Find a Grave, listed Elia as buried in a non-denominational cemetery in Stone Mountain, Georgia. That's a suburb just a little northeast of the city. But when we visited, the office staff told us they had no record of her being buried there. We eventually tracked down a funeral notice that listed Elia under her more formal name, Banderas Campos, and was printed in the Atlanta Constitution. After a service for family and friends held at a small chapel in Sandy Springs, Georgia, Elia was taken back to Mexico City, where her parents lived. She was buried there. A representative of the Westin Hotel, though not identified as such in the funeral notice, was the one who organized a memorial fund. And that's all we can tell you about Elia's life leading up to December 30th and how her family coped with the crime. Like many victims, more is known about her moment of attack than the breadth of her experience. Elia was murdered in the middle of the day while revelers gathered outside the hotel in preparation for the Peach Bowl, a major college football event. There was a parade, and thousands were in town just for the New Year's celebration. The Westin was busy, not sold out, but its likely reservations and its spinning rooftop restaurant were. That year, Atlanta was on many minds. After all, the Olympics would take place in our city in the next year, and many of those guests wanted to see the city's made-over skyline. That morning, staff reported several unusual interactions with the public. Two incidents in particular are worth mentioning here. Westin employees relayed these stories to investigators after Elia's death. Sometime between 9:30 and 11 a.m., a front desk clerk, we'll call Angela, was approached by a thin, youngish white man. He was carrying a yellow bag with the letters W.H. Smith printed on the side, which, to the best of our knowledge, is a British retailer. He struck Angela as someone who might have been living on the streets, and he was jumpy. He asked Angela what was going on in the city, which she probably found odd. The Peach Bowl signs were up everywhere, and a parade was in full swing. And then he asked her about employment at the Westin. She directed him toward some pamphlets in a seating area. He then told Angela that he'd come from San Diego, but had gotten into an argument with the friend he'd been staying with. He couldn't go back and he couldn't talk about it. He retrieved pamphlets twice, went to the seating area three times, and came back to the front counter to ask about work again. Angela finally suggested he try the Fairfield Inn. He wandered off as more guests arrived, and she didn't see him again, but she remembered him, his baggy blazer, grown-out crew cut, and his strange smile. He was maybe in his early 30s. She didn't say he was under the influence, but some aspects of her statement imply that pretty heavily. The second report comes from a housekeeper we'll call Camilla, who was Elia's friend. She had a few important details for the investigators. She reported that yet another housekeeper, not Elia, had earlier complained of a stalker who'd been hanging around the hotel. As at most hotels, both then and now, housekeepers cleaned alone. We don't know if management ever heard anything about this purported stalker. Was he someone who the unnamed staff member knew from life or a stranger who just hung around the hotel? But that wasn't the only disturbing story offered by Camilla. In fact, she'd had her own encounter with a strange man, one that took place only minutes before Elia's attack. Camilla had spoken to Elia just that morning. She'd asked her to help her out by finishing off a room on the 46th floor. Camilla needed time to go and file an accident report because she'd hurt her back cleaning. The problem was she wouldn't have enough time to file the report during her short lunch break and still get the minimum number of rooms done. So she'd actually called the floor Elia was working on to ask for that help. It's unclear whether it was to a hallway line or the room Elia was cleaning, but it was certainly a hotel line. Neither of them had a cell phone. Most people didn't in 1995, and none of our research indicates the staff had any centralized communication system like walkie-talkies. Elia couldn't leave her current job because the guest room was occupied, which meant the customers would be back soon. But she promised that after she finished, she'd join Camilla and help her out before they headed down to the cafeteria for lunch. Camilla waited, but Elia didn't arrive. And finally, Camilla pushed her cart down the hall, passing the main bank of elevators on the floor. She was all alone, or she thought she was. It's unclear whether she planned to board an elevator with her cart or if one simply opened as she passed by. Either way, she was startled to see a young man appear beside her. "You scared me," she told him. He apologized, but he didn't move out of her way. Out of nervousness, Camilla paused and picked up the hotel courtesy phone, which sat on a small table just outside the elevator. She pretended to make a call. She didn't want the man to think she was all alone. If she held the phone long enough, she thought he might eventually wander off, as it would be the polite thing to do. Her ruse didn't work. As Camilla spoke quietly into the dial tone, the young man drew closer, and that was when she saw how bloodshot his eyes were. Alcohol or drugs, she wasn't sure, but she would later describe him to a sketch artist as following. White, mid-20s, maybe 5'7", very thin. Hair somewhere between blonde and brown, cut into what the police report as a rat tail. Red-tinged eyes, thin lips. She remembered him wearing light denim jeans and a slightly darker denim jacket, with maybe a red shirt. He stood there looking at her, and then he gestured to a room across the hall. "Can you let me in there?" he asked. "I want to see the view." Normally, Camilla would have acquiesced. She was well-versed in the wow factor customer service that luxury hotels promise to provide. But this man frightened her. She apologized and said she had to go to another floor, and then headed quickly down the hall to the service elevator, hoping that he wouldn't follow. She'd finish those rooms later. She'd look for Elia in the cafeteria. Based on our interviews and national data, Camilla had likely had uncomfortable experiences with guests before, maybe even that week or day. Until the police questioned her, she didn't mention the man to anyone. He hadn't done anything that management would consider egregious enough for action. He'd only asked to see a room. So there was no reason, really, to have him removed. And then, 60 floors up and only a few minutes later, Elia was attacked. As we said, she was cleaning a guest-occupied room, which meant she needed to work quickly and efficiently before those guests returned. She must have been nearly finished, and we don't know if the Westin at that time had a closed-door or an open-door cleaning policy. Both methods of either propping a door open with a cart or keeping the door shut have supporters and detractors. Some housekeepers consider an open door to be safer because it's easier to call for help, but others believe it signals to potential predators or harassers that staff is present. Some hotels consider a closed door policy as an invitation to accuse staff of theft, and others an open door is tacky, spoiling the illusion of invisible service. It's most likely, though, that Elia had the door open, or at least that she went into the hall to retrieve something. How else would her attacker have known she was there? We won't delve into the graphic details of her attack, but some aspects need to be mentioned in order to explain the scene. Because she was suddenly and furiously beaten with an on-hand weapon, perhaps something that might be viewed as spontaneous rather than premeditated, if one didn't consider the rest of the crime. She wasn't robbed, and nothing was stolen from the room. A pair of earrings were found separated on one of the room's two beds, but that likely happened during the attack. Elia was fully dressed when she was found. No obvious signs of sexual assault were apparent. This was a purposeful, extraordinarily violent beating. Blood pooled between the beds and in patches in front of the closet, and her skull was fractured. And yet, no one heard a thing. No one noticed anything amiss until the guest who returned to the room attempted to unlock their door, but found it blocked. The guests were a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law, and the women were surprised to find that they couldn't enter the room. Based on the layout of the hotel room, it may be that Elia herself was blocking the door and was then later moved to a position between the beds. But the attacker could have also positioned himself against the interior door to keep the guests from entering. They'd struggled with it for a few minutes when a man burst out of the room, jacket pulled up over his head. He shoved past them and ran down the hall, and they didn't get a good look. He was young, white, thin, wearing what the guest described as a leather jacket. The man Camilla saw was wearing a denim jacket. Could there really have been two separate similar men 16 floors apart? Unlikely. It's pure speculation, but perhaps the lining or quilting of the suspect's denim jacket was brown. That variation was common enough in the 1990s. Maybe the witnesses were mistaken. They only saw him for a moment, and then he was gone. The guest contacted the front desk, and the hotel's own guards were dispatched to check on the scene. One of them checked Elia for a pulse and thought he felt one. Based on a 911 call received from the hotel, EMTs recorded the incident as a sexual assault rather than a murder, which led to some confusion regarding the state of the victim and what tests should be run. When EMTs arrived on the scene, they attempted life-saving measures, including the cutting of the clothing, to better use emergency equipment. This is worth noting because it may have led to initial inconsistencies in reporting on and of the crime, which is absolutely normal in the earliest stages of a case. During all that chaos, the attacker escaped. There was a fire alarm pulled on the 55th floor, halfway between where Elia was found and Camilla was accosted. Blood on the 55th and 54th stairwell doors proved the attacker took the stairs during at least part of his escape, and that he had not left completely unscathed. Elia had fought him in hard. Some of his blood was found in the room and on those doors, and in her hand was a clump of brownish blonde hair. At this point, we should be able to say something about Elia, her strength, her bravery, something specific and unique to who she was, but we don't know enough about her. Though we've reached out, we haven't made contact with those who loved her and might have shared those details. Police reports help, and so do archival articles, but they are only a record of events we recite at the beginning of a story. Elia had barely begun her residence in Atlanta. She was busy. She had to have been, with three young children, a full-time job, and her partner across the country. She was well-liked by other staff. She rode Atlanta's MARTA transit system each day, taking the train and a bus to get to work. She had a close, extended family who gathered to hold a service in Georgia and then took her home, to Mexico City, to be buried. This isn't enough of a eulogy for a woman who was simply doing her job and had no way to signal that she needed help when danger came. Like Carolyn and like Camilla, she was working alone. And what were the Westin's precise security standards and protocols in 1995? We've been unable to get official confirmation on the specifics, but based on our research and on our own interviews with housekeepers who've worked then, now, or both, they were likely limited. There would have been several security guards in a hotel that size, but likely not a guard assigned specifically to staff safety. There likely would not have been a specific protocol for what guest actions were reportable to management and which weren't, especially when those actions were not clear physical threats. And Camilla's interaction with a stranger, how would she have reported that? A man asked to see a room? The housekeepers we spoke to had varying experiences, but one thing we consistently heard was that whether management was supportive or unsupportive, there was often a hesitancy to report incidents involving guests or those who might be perceived as guests. The man that Camilla saw was odd and had reddened eyes, but it was also a holiday in a big city with a huge football game happening. A large part of the population was probably drinking that day. Housekeepers often find their own ways to deal with problems. One told us that she carried a spray bottle of vinegar to fend off aggressive guests. She wouldn't risk arrest for using a strong chemical in her own defense. Several mentioned wearing extra clothing, if it was allowed in uniform policies, to provide layers of protection. Others talked about the daily questions they got. Do you come with a room? Are you included in the turndown service? That everyone experienced. Based on national statistics and our own interviews, it's likely that Elia and Camilla were harassed in the months leading up to the attack and likely multiple times. It would feel normal. And they'd be expected to deal with strangers, usually guests, but how would they know for sure, efficiently and without trouble. And there was no way to summon help if it was needed, not quickly and not on the 46th or 60th floor of a building. As one current housekeeper wrote to us, there are plenty of other women waiting to take the job. We heard that a lot. A housekeeper who asked to be identified as Jess from Ontario wrote, quote, "Most high-end resorts use temp agencies. You say anything and you're out of a job with no notice. No one feels safe enough to speak out. There's always 100 other girls behind you who can replace you." And when discussing safety concerns, she wrote, quote, "It's considered part of the risks of the job." Another housekeeper, BK from Arizona, wrote to us that, quote, "We weren't allowed to use the in-room phones. If there were any issues or concerns, we had to report them in person to a supervising housekeeper or a head of housekeeping, no exceptions." From the outside, maybe it seems like there would be other avenues. What about reporting guest behavior straight to law enforcement and avoiding the hotel altogether? Feasibility there would depend on the employee in question and how safe she felt in doing so. If that worker was part of a community not historically supported or protected by law enforcement, what then? What if she didn't have legal documentation to hold the job? And if she was hurt or killed, could her family then even actively pursue resolution? It wasn't the responsibility of Camilla or any other member of housekeeping to secure the hotel. In fact, one of their many tasks was to make the space inviting and welcoming. This is one of the many factors that made Camilla and Elia vulnerable. That December, after Elia's attack, the APD acted quickly. What the Westin did remains unknown. Security updates were mentioned, but not specifically detailed in media coverage. But we know another woman was attacked in 1996. Within a day of Elia's murder, the Atlanta Police Department had issued a call for a man they called a, quote, witness to come forward. News outlets never used the word suspect, though the description roughly matched what both Camilla and the guest described. A slim white man, longish hair, somewhere between blonde and brown. But the APD also began to develop their own leads, mostly based on two things: criminal history and/or proximity to the Westin at the time of Elia's attack. There were troubling clues in the hotel itself. Outside of bloodstains on the stairwell doors and carpets, the housekeeping staff stumbled upon a closet full, literally, of evidence on the 64th floor. A housekeeper entered a linen closet to find clear signs that at least one person, likely male, had been occupying the space for some time. They found several articles of men's clothing, cigarette butts, and discarded food wrappers. And there were several hotel key cards there, too. It looked as if someone had slept on a pile of sheets. Samples were taken and sent to the lab, along with the evidence from Elia's attack. And the police continued to follow leads, especially concerning slim white men. Meanwhile, things, at least at the hotel, began to return to normal, even as Elia's friends mourned her and as her family came to Georgia to make arrangements for her funeral and for her children. And then, a few weeks later, there was another attack. A hotel guest staying on the 64th floor was assaulted in a room, just like Elia, in the early afternoon, when she should have felt the most secure. In 1996, the AJC reported that this assailant, who beat Polly Cirola so brutally that her skull was crushed, had brought a weapon with him and taken it when he left. That's one departure from Elia's case, where the attacker used a weapon of opportunity, the phone. But in many other respects, the cases are extraordinarily similar. Neither victim showed signs of obvious sexual assault. Both were beaten and strangled, and significantly, nothing was stolen from either room. There was speculation that the attacker had hidden in a storage closet or area for at least a short period of time before the attack, or was perhaps simply on the floor at the same time the guest arrived back at her room, ready to gather her belongings and head back to Vermont. He likely forced his way in as she unlocked her door. In February of 1996, Polly was in town to attend a conference. She was an incredibly respected person in her field, both as a physical therapist and as an educator with a PhD. The AP reports that from 1988 until the time of her attack, Polly ran the University of Colorado's physical therapy program. There, she mentored countless students and also served as an assistant dean. Polly, who was 56 that February, was a leading academic and practitioner. She was well-known and highly respected in her field and was excited to attend the conference with several colleagues from her program and to meet and network with the best in her field. Polly had chosen not to marry and did not have children, though at the time of her death, she was dating an old high school friend. She had many friends and a close extended family and was particularly close to her nephew, Jeff Martell, who was kind enough to speak with us about his aunt's life. He described her as strong and kind and incredibly dedicated to her profession, explaining that teaching was her thing and that she loved it. It was Jeff's family who police contacted after Polly's attack.
Actually, I was at work. It was February 16th, 1996, and I got a phone call at around 3:15 or 3:30 in the afternoon that my aunt was attacked and strangled and that she was not expected to live through the night. She was at the Grady Trauma Center down in Atlanta. I hustled and was able to make a flight out of Burlington, Vermont, which is our closest airport, and flew down there that evening to, you know, be with her at the hospital. She was actually on her way. She was going to leave the physical therapy conference early and fly out and come to Vermont to visit us. Our family stayed with me in my house, my wife and children. So that's why she was alone in the room. She had stepped out of the conference a bit early to go to the room to make it to the airport in time to make a flight north.
The next description may be difficult for listeners to hear. It was certainly incredibly difficult for Jeff to experience. So, in particular, for the next minute or so, listener discretion is advised.
She was in a really horrible state. She had significant brain trauma, bruising all over her face and neck. Her neck was swollen. Her eyes were swollen shut. She basically, was not recognizable in terms of how I'm used to seeing her. She had, one of the visible things that occurred to me was she had a gold necklace on, and the trauma of the strangulation left an imprint around her neck where the chains had dug into her neck. She had a broken ocular, the bone around her eye. I'm not sure if I'm using the right word or not, but and she was on all kinds of life support to keep her alive.
Jeff met Detective Masterson, the same APD officer who worked Elia's case, and his family was made aware of the similarities. After that meeting, they had semi-regular contact over the years until Masterson retired. But Jeff said no real leads ever panned out. Polly, still in a coma, remained at Grady for 2 weeks and was then transferred up north to be closer to family. That began a series of moves from one specialty facility to another. She was at the first center when she emerged from the coma, something doctors thought wouldn't happen. After that, she was in intensive rehab and was able to regain some movement and the ability to hold simple conversations and even offer answers to questions. But as Jeff and his family learned, Polly wouldn't be able to offer clues in her own case.
She never got to the state where she could answer any questions that were, she knew something happened to her, obviously. But she, if you asked her, who did the attack or anything like that, she just couldn't give you an appropriate answer. We were never able to, find any details out from the attack from her directly.
Polly's recovery was complicated by an infection caused by a surgery she'd had while comatose, a feeding tube installation. Jeff tells us that the issue went undetected for a long time, and by the time it was caught, Polly was gravely ill.
I'm not a medical expert, but the anesthesia has real negative effects to anybody that's brain injured. Mm-hmm. So when she came out of the surgery at Concord, she really lost everything she had gained and then some. We had to transfer to her place where she really required full-time care. Had, you know, they had to feed her and change her and shower her and all the things that you and I take for granted every day.
Though they stayed involved in her case, Polly's physical well-being was the family's major focus. Different officers were available and on the case at different times, which made it more complex for the family to keep up with the progress. There was a reward offered by the American Physical Therapy Association, who also fundraised for Polly's care, but the case still stagnated. When Polly passed away in 2011 at the age of 71 and in a care facility, her death was ruled a homicide, a result of the injury she suffered in 1996. And her unidentified attacker would now, if apprehended, be charged with murder. Obviously, Jeff and his family want his aunt's attacker caught, but a lack of leads wasn't the only issue. National news did not focus on the December and February attacks, though the story was, at its face, unusual. Two women beaten in the same luxury hotel at midday, only weeks apart. To put it in perspective, the most well-covered non-celebrity crime of 1996 was the death of JonBenet Ramsey. But that news break didn't come until December, nearly 10 months after the attacks. So why the lack of attention, of reviews of each woman's life? We don't have a statement about what Elia's friends and family would want you to know about her life, but we do have one from Jeff on his Aunt Polly. He says she tried to make the world a better place. And based on her work and the effect she had on her colleagues and students and her clients, she succeeded in that. Since Polly's death in 2011, there have been no new leads. But in 1996, various avenues were explored. Police felt then that the crimes were likely connected, not a leap. And the men who worked and lived and congregated near the Westin were investigated. That basic profile of a young white male in his 20s or early 30s was the guide, but it was not a hard limitation. A window washer was cleared, as were other men working nearby. Men with histories of violence were questioned. And though DNA technology was still new and testing could often use up a sample, blood typing and early DNA comparison were done and were useful in ruling out several immediate suspects. The man that police most wanted to speak with, though, would take longer to examine. They issued an arrest warrant for Sonny Hamilton, the man that they had described as a possible witness. According to the Atlanta Constitution, the technical reason for the warrant was a probation violation regarding an incident at the Westin itself. It seems that Sonny had a history with the hotel. Based on various news reports from both Atlanta papers, Sonny and the Atlanta police had a very different version of the events that led to his arrest in 1993. Police said that he had terrorized two women, eventually shutting off power to 10 elevators at the Westin and chasing guests throughout the building. Several people were trapped on those elevators for the duration of the attack. After the women, who were guests at the hotel at the time, escaped into a room, the Atlanta Constitution reports that Sonny placed a teacup over the peephole so they could not see out. The women were able to call for help, first hotel security and then the police, but the ordeal lasted for hours. And after being apprehended, Sonny made what the APD considered to be terroristic threats to return to the hotel. But when the Atlanta Constitution interviewed Sonny in 1996, he said, quote, he was framed by hotel security guards who beat him after he chased two women guests in 1993. He denied allegations that he threatened to return to the hotel. He also denied police reports that he shut off power to 10 elevators there. He said, I whistled at them and followed them. I'd been drinking, and they said I scared them. The Constitution further quoted Sonny as saying, quote, security guards put surgical gloves on and took turns slapping me and hitting me in the stomach. I had my own pool cue, and they took that out and they hit me with it. Fulton County Superior Court would later convict Hamilton of this attack. He was eventually placed on probation and moved with his girlfriend to Rock Hill, South Carolina, about 4 hours from Atlanta, where he worked in construction. After news articles on both cases came out and the press releases hit, Sonny caught a ride down to the APD central office and turned himself in. On paper, Sonny was a good suspect. He was a fairly close physical match for the sketch, and he had a history of assault at the Westin. But he passed a polygraph test administered soon after his arrest, though the police did not treat that as exclusion from culpability. But when the blood and DNA test came back, Sonny wasn't a match. In Elia's case, there was blood from two people, including the victim at the scene. And Sonny was cleared in her case and in Polly's. And his girlfriend was also thoroughly questioned. And to this day, she maintains that he was actually with her in Rock Hill at the time of both attacks. We spoke to her in late 2018, and she again confirmed that fact. She said that Sonny didn't have a driver's license at the time, much less a car. And so the APD were back at the beginning, with a suspect description. They believed that the attacker would have been injured in Elia's attack. The differing blood evidence backed that up, and so they questioned local hospitals in hopes of finding records that matched the perpetrator. Because some of the swabs were completely used up in early DNA testing, they had to be careful with what remained, but have regularly run evidence against national registries in hopes of a hit. They investigated a suspect reported by a local pawn shop owner who'd seen the composite sketch. And they reviewed more evidence, this time found on the 60th floor of the hotel, later, which included a used condom and food wrappers. The evidence was discovered in January of 1996, between the two attacks. Whether the person or persons who had squatted in the hotel were involved in either murder is unknown, but it's clear that they were able to breach security on numerous occasions and move about the Westin undisturbed. Violent attacks can happen anywhere, and we know this, and it's impossible to plan for every possibility or danger. But there are vital security measures that, if put in place, can lower the risks of such events and can shield both staff and guests. One of the most vital fail-safes is a better system for tracking problems and recording interactions, so there's awareness of and responsibility taken for potentially dangerous situations. One of the most common examples of such a situation is the verbal and physical harassment of housekeepers, often by repeat offenders who grow bolder with each instance. In 2016, the Chicago chapter of Unite Here conducted a poll of over 500 women in the hotel and casino industries. In it, 58% of hotel workers said they'd been sexually harassed. That same study reported that 49% of housekeepers have had guests answer the door naked, expose themselves, or flash them. The statistics on other aggressive behavior, attacks, and violence are less readily available. Because the more often discussed statistics on sexual harassment and violence have become more popular in the mainstream media since 2011, when Dominique Strauss-Kahn, a former French politician, assaulted a luxury hotel housekeeper. Criminal charges were dropped, but a civil suit was settled for an undisclosed amount. Major hotel chains reported that in the wake of that news that they would be reviewing safety protocols. But Elia was attacked and murdered in 1995. The interest in the safety of hotel staff wasn't yet a blip on the mainstream radar. A 2002 FBI report on workplace violence separates those violent incidents into four types. Type 1, violence committed by a non-customer, and Type 2, violence committed by a customer, are the most applicable to housekeepers. Most workplace crimes fall under Type 1, with incidents sharply declining since a peak in the mid-90s, probably based entirely on security measures taken by business owners. Panic buttons, emergency plans, buddy systems, more cameras, patrols, all of these have proven essential aspects of workplace safety. But in the housekeeping industry, where women work alone, those measures are slower in coming. Many of the housekeepers we interviewed describe supportive, caring managers, but those managers do not have the authority to provide a hotel or chain-wide security overhaul. Kate, a former housekeeper who you heard at the top of the episode, couldn't recall any specific security protocols for reporting incidents. And based on our email and phone interviews with housekeepers, that lack was the norm. One former luxury hotel employee wrote in to discuss an attack on a housekeeper, which occurred in the mid-2000s. They wrote, quote, "I was working at a luxury hotel from 2006 to 2014, and there was a guest who tried to molest a housekeeper. I was at the front desk and was horrified to hear the housekeeping manager tell our female director of operations the story. The housekeeper had been alone in the room and managed to push the man off of her and run away. The director of operations solution was for the rest of the man's stay, he'd have his room serviced by a male housekeeper. She refused to involve police or kick the man out. The housekeeper got the rest of the day off, a few hours at probably $12 an hour, with pay, and that was it." Another former housekeeper shared her story via email and also gave some professional insight into the hiring and safety practices in the housekeeping industry. To preserve her privacy, her experience will be read by a voice actor.
"I first did housekeeping at a mountain resort in the summer. The work was hard, but overall not bad. For me and the other white American students, that is. We worked in teams to clean hotels and cabins, and no one was ever alone for long. There were problems with some of the labor practices there. Skimming off the overtime, not providing gloves or proper cleaning materials, especially for the foreign exchange students working there. But it didn't feel unsafe. I took that for granted until I took a job cleaning hotel rooms in a Hampton Inn near my university. I had assumed we would work in groups, but actually we were sent out alone, one person per floor most weekdays. I still get a tingle on the back of my neck now thinking of it. Those long, poorly lit hallways with all the doors, just so creepy. I was always concerned about someone coming up behind me or entering a room behind me, so I made a habit of always keeping the cart in the door or right behind me. One time, I had knocked on the door multiple times, as you're taught, and hollered again when I entered. I am a very loud person, so I knew that anyone could hear me. I came in and set my cart in the door when I heard someone clear their throat. A man, about 50, balding, was just standing there naked. I left in a hurry, apologizing the whole way out. But the minute I went out of the room, I knew he did it on purpose. He hadn't tried to cover himself. He didn't look surprised. He was waiting there with his hands on his bare hips and a blank expression. I told my supervisors, but they insisted that I had forgotten to announce myself. I quit not long after that, not telling anyone else about the exposed man. I was 19 and confused, and sure that if I told someone else, they'd brush it off like my supervisors did. That's the worst that happened to me, but I am also a tall white citizen. I can imagine what happens to women in hotels when they are alone, when they are small, and they lack the language or status to protect themselves. I work with refugees and help find employment for them. When they first arrive to the United States, refugee women are usually placed in hotels, since they don't need a lot of English to do the work. The clients I work with have been in the U.S. for longer, and none of them will take a hotel job. They'd rather work for less pay in factories than clean hotels. Often, they are not forthcoming about their experiences, but one woman told me, you go in a room, anything can be inside. Maybe just a mess, maybe a bad man. You don't know, and you're all alone. She didn't want to say more, and I don't blame her. In my position now, I often tell hotel managers that ask to be a part of our job fairs that I will place people there if they change their policies and have housekeepers work in teams and have a translator go over sexual harassment laws with them. No one is interested.
When we put out a call for housekeeper stories, we mostly heard from white women. But national coverage has included experiences from a diverse group of workers: citizens, non-citizens, Asian, Latinx, white, black, native English speakers, and non-native speakers. And one thing that stood out was that job security, or the perception of job security, was a major concern in the willingness to report or to seek support when an incident occurred. As several of our interviewees noted, coworkers with precarious citizenship or sponsorship status those with work visas dependent on employment or perhaps a lack of documentation, were the least likely to seek help when harassment occurred. And that issue was bigger than just the hotel industry. In a 2017 Seattle Times article, co-authors Victoria Vasquez, Phyllis Gutierrez, and Guadalupe Gamboa wrote, quote, "Immigrant workers are the economic powerhouses in our communities. They are the workers who harvest your fruits and vegetables, clean your offices, turn down your hotel beds, and serve and cook your food. Power and fear play a large part in victimizing all workers, but immigrant workers face even greater barriers to protecting themselves due to language, isolation, and poverty. When they experience sexual harassment, they don't have the option of a famous person to publicly shame." But there are worker-led organizations that want to decrease worker isolation and increase community strength. Unite Here, which we've mentioned before, represents workers, quote, in the hotel, gaming, food service, manufacturing, textile distribution, laundry, transportation, and airport industries. And Unite Here has been particularly active in the reform of hotel policy, where their local chapter membership is diverse and represents accurate pictures of the industry's true demographic. The Atlanta chapter, Local 23, is to our best knowledge still led by a bartender at the Westin Peachtree Plaza. Wanda Brown has regularly been quoted in articles concerning local industry safety, especially after the 2016 death of Carolyn Mangum. In the weeks following Mangum's entrapment in the hotel freezer, Brown was quoted in the AJC as saying, quote, "At the end of the day, everyone deserves to go home to their families. We've given our demands to the hotel, and we're waiting for a response, and we will not stop asking for these things to be done." So in 2019, 23 years after the deaths of Elia and Polly, 3 years after the deaths of Carolyn, how does security at the Westin stand? We don't know if they plan to follow parent company Marriott's implementation plan, which would have systems installed into properties by 2020. We do know that security measures have vastly improved in some cities, but there's no overriding industry standard, especially when panic buttons or systems are involved. Panic buttons, whether they are individually carried by housekeepers, which is a strong preference among activists, or installed in some intermittent manner through a hotel, are seen as a basic first-line defense for workers. A personal panic button certainly would have helped Carolyn Mangum. Elia might have been saved before she sustained fatal injuries. Camilla might have felt empowered to alert security about the strange man who asked to see a room. In a number of cities like Washington, D.C., Seattle, New York, Las Vegas, local union chapters have successfully made progress towards safer working environments, which can in turn benefit guests and the hotel's reputation. It's a win-win situation. But some in the hotel industry have argued against the cost of these panic buttons. Bloomberg cited an internal American Hospitality and Lodging Association document that allegedly explained that the widespread use of panic buttons was, quote, deemed by many experts and hoteliers to be a solution in search of a problem. They've gotten half of that equation right. It's a solution. But what they're missing is a true acknowledgement of the many problems systemic to the industry. Kimberly DeRazzo, a Unite Here labor leader, was quoted in a November 2017 Huffington Post article where she pointed out that basic security measures will never fully solve the problem. As author Dave Jamieson wrote, quote, "But according to DeRazzo, the panic buttons only go so far in addressing the more fundamental problem, an imbalance of economic power between the perpetrators and their victims, especially when the victims are working in or near poverty." He goes on to quote DeRazzo, who explained that, quote, "We have to do something to equalize power so that women really have the ability to speak up without having to risk their livelihood. That goes for whether you're a housekeeper or a food server or a big-time actor." So, how do you change the hotel industry? There are some practical approaches. Improved labor standards so that workers are not suffering injuries at a much higher rate than those in similar fields. checks and balances and systems in place, protocols and reports, and action to empower housekeepers to report and punish perpetrators in a meaningful way. But there's a first step that takes a century of industry unraveling to complete. We have to learn to see domestic workers again. There should have been more eulogy to offer a woman like Elia Banderas, whose short, precise funeral notice served as the only real clue into her life. If she had been someone else, somewhere else, the coverage perhaps would have done more to attract attention and maybe even help identify her killer. Maybe that could have saved the life of Polly Sarasoli, too. Maybe Carolyn Mangum would have made it home from her shift that night in 2016. If you have any information regarding the deaths of Elia Banderas or Polly Sarasoli, please call the Atlanta Police Department Homicide Unit at 404-546-4235 or call Crime Stoppers of Atlanta anonymously at 404-577-8477. Again, the suspect description, circa 1995, would have been a thin white male, likely in his mid-20s, wearing his blondish-brown hair and a rat tail. He likely would have been a habitual user of drugs or alcohol, lived in Atlanta, and worn a denim jacket. He may have been staying on the streets that winter. If you have any information that could aid a cold case investigator, get in touch. There are rewards in Polly and Elia's cases that may still be active today. Special thanks to Lainey Hobbs of the podcast True Crime Fan Club, who read one of the listener letters, and to our content advisors, Professor Marcela Fuentes, author of the upcoming novel Malas, Winter Wheeler, and Brandy Williams. Our chief research assistant is Haley Gray, with additional research assistance by Kim Fritz. We'll be back next week with two cases from the early 1990s, the unsolved murders of a trans woman, Tracy Thompson, in Cordell, Georgia, and of Robert Martin, a gay man whose fluid gender expression was poorly understood and received in his small town of Ashburn, Georgia. We hope you'll join us then.